but naturally express the good, living spontaneously out of love, for someone aware of the oneness cannot help but express unqualified love for all beings. Paul writes, love is the pleroma of the law, meaning love is the perfect archetype of which moral codes are inadequate images. He explains that when we have identified with Christ, the universal consciousness which is our essence, we are discharged from the law to serve God in a new way, the way of spirit, in contrast to the old way of the written code. The purpose of the psychic initiation is to help us transcend ethical ideas about how to be good and discover the essential loving goodness which we are, so that we can live spontaneously from the heart. Clement boldly proclaims, all the actions of those possessed of gnosis are right actions, and the actions of those not possessed of gnosis are wrong actions, even though they conform with a code. Whilst we still identify with the ego, all our actions are ultimately selfish, whatever the outward appearance of righteousness. When we stop identifying with the ego, our actions are God's actions, undistorted by the illusion of separateness. We find ourselves unerringly expressing the will of God, which, as Basilides teaches, is simply to desire nothing, to hate nothing, and to love all. Irenaeus is outraged that Christian Gnostics proclaim that the realization of gnosis sets them free to act spontaneously, regardless of moral conventions. He writes indignantly, they maintain that they have attained to such heights that they are therefore free in every respect to act as they please and have no fear of doing anything. But the spiritually awake are impervious to the condemnation of religious moralists such as Irenaeus. As Paul explains, because they are no longer under the control of their lower nature, but directed by consciousness, they can judge the worth of everything, but can't be judged by others. They are indeed, as Irenaeus says, free and without fear. The pneumatic initiation. Whilst the psychic initiation teaches us how to live as an apparent part of the One, the pneumatic initiation reveals to us that essentially we are the One. This is done through transformative philosophy. But in the same way that Gnostic ethics is about love, not laws, Gnostic philosophy is about revelation, not theories. Gnostic philosophers use ideas to propel us beyond ideas to their source in the mystery. They use words to wake people from their thinking to the vision, as Plotinus puts it. Pythagoras defines the goal of philosophy as knowledge of being. Clement teaches that the objective of philosophical contemplation is knowledge of being itself. Plotinus explains, the highest concern of philosophy is being. Philosophy helps us cultivate an awareness of something so obvious we usually ignore it, and yet so wonderful it is infinitely mysterious. That we exist. It teaches us to be conscious that we are conscious, and so not missing out on the greatest miracle of all, that we are a witness to the whole incredible show. Philosophy undermines the conceptual mindset that we have unconsciously inherited from our culture and mistaken for reality. It reasons us back to basics, taking us from the complexity of the world to simple underlying principles. Eventually, we arrive at the idea of the primal syzygy, the mystery manifesting as consciousness and psyche. As Paul teaches, this understanding acts like a two-edged sword, which cuts so deeply it divides consciousness from psyche. It enables us to distinguish ourselves as the experiencer from what we are experiencing, and so disengage from the psyche body, entering a state the ancients called theoria, meaning contemplation, or hesychia, meaning stillness, in which we identify with the ineffable witness of our unfolding psychophysical experiences. To deepen this awareness of being consciousness, we must ignore all our thoughts, feelings, and sensations, and focus on the empty presence within which they rise and fall, entering what Dionysius calls the mysterious darkness of unknowing, in which we transcend consciousness by knowing nothing. In this state, consciousness turns back on itself to commune with the dazzling darkness, the mysterious oneness from which the primal duality of consciousness and psyche arises. Plotinus explains that the transcending of consciousness in the individual is identical with the first moment of creation. He teaches, the vision is not something that must be entered into, but something present before all else, before consciousness made any movements at all. The Christian text Alogenes gives us a mythical account of the process of pneumatic initiation, through which we commune with the unknowable one. Alogenes, whose name means foreigner, is a stranger in the world on a return journey to his true home. The goddess guides him in making an ascent, which is inwards, until he reaches stillness at the level of being, the state of contemplation in which he can become aware of the dazzling darkness of the mystery. The goddess teaches Alogenes that there is nothing he can do to bring about a primal revelation of the unknowable one, since what obscures the realization of the oneness is the idea of himself as an autonomous agent separate from the one. He must therefore completely disidentify with the active personal ego and be passive, impersonal, witnessing consciousness. She explains, to receive a primal revelation of the unknowable one, withdraw to the rear of activity, become perfectly still in that place. Any desire to be an active agent will cause you to fall from the inactivity of the unknowable one. The goddess warns Alogenes that even thinking he has come to know the one will obscure the mystery of consciousness with an idea. Do not know the unknowable one, for that is impossible. If by means of an enlightened thought you seem to know him, be ignorant of him. The goddess is encouraging Alogenes to enter a state of deep meditative contemplation by withdrawing his awareness from the circumference of the circle of self towards the center of consciousness. In so doing, he is in effect approaching the state of deep sleep whilst remaining conscious. This can be a helpful practice because it acquaints us with the unfamiliar, silent depths of our being, but we cannot remain indefinitely in such a state of retreat. The other side of our syzygistic nature will call us back to body awareness. As we spiritually mature, however, we become simultaneously conscious of our everyday experience and of communing with the unknowable one. Plotinus teaches, does consciousness see in part now one vision and now the other? No. In reality, consciousness has the power of thought eternally, and also the power of suspending thought and looking to the one in another way. When we look in both ways at once, we know who we are. We are the whole become conscious of itself through a part. We are the one seeming to be someone. We are universal being appearing to be a human being. We are the mystery of God dreaming it's a person. We are the one in many forms on a journey from the dazzling darkness of unconscious unity through the separate ego's experience of conscious variety to the enlightened sage's conscious awareness of unity in variety. The love affair of life. Gnosis is becoming aware of our divinity, but not by rejecting our humanity. It is true that the Gnostic masters portray human incarnation in a negative light as a form of imprisonment from which we need to escape. But that is only half the story. They also portray it in a positive light, as an opportunity to spiritually awaken that we should embrace. If we understand the paradox at the heart of the Gnosis, we can see that these apparently contradictory teachings are actually complementary, because both are true. To know the one, we must escape from identification with the separate self, yet this process of spiritual awakening can only happen to an individual. Gnosis is not retreating from life. It is valuing human incarnation as a precious opportunity to commune with the oneness through the multiplicity, to discover the good through the good and bad, to find love through separation. Gnosis is not being the one instead of a separate individual, but as well. It is living as God and man after the mythical example of Jesus. Far from rejecting the world as a worthless illusion, Gnosis is participating fully in the process of redeeming the Kanoma by transforming it into the perfect image of the pleromic archetypes. For, as the Christian Gnostic Marcenes teaches, in every respect, the sense-perceptible cosmos is worthy of being saved in its entirety. Gnosis is playing a part in creating heaven on earth by collectively dreaming a perfect dream of unity and love instead of the present nightmare of division and strife. Christian mythology sees this ideal as being realized at the end of time, when all the seeds of consciousness realize their true identity and the whole of the Kanoma is united in Gnosis. This state of absolute Gnosis is then something we can only realize together. We are all one, and we can only realize that oneness as one. This means that until we all realize Gnosis, no one can. Unless all beings are freed from ignorance and suffering, none can be fully free of ignorance and suffering. Individually, our realization of Gnosis is a relative experience of the absolute mystery. It is not a state of having awakened, but a process of continually awakening to deeper levels of self-discovery. We can never reach the good, so things can always get better. As individuals in time, Gnosis is a temporary recognition of our eternal nature. The ground of all experience is constant, but our experience of it fluctuates. Gnosis is always something we are growing towards or falling away from. Whilst we are relatively aware that all is one, everything happens perfectly of itself. Without the interference of the distorting ego, we don't miss the mark. We are borne along by the natural flow of life. When we look in the mirror of psyche, all we see is God. The world is permeated with intelligence and abundant with love. But sooner or later, our self-orientation pulls us back into identification with the eidolon. We persevere with the psychic process of personal transformation to prevent this come-down occurring so often, and so deepen the pneumatic awareness of oneness. The Christian way is to progressively perfect so that we can increasingly transcend. Pythagoreans call the levels of initiation the active life and the contemplative life. The Christian way is being at once an active and contemplative image of God, as Theodotus puts it. It is living both the active life of perfecting the evolving eidolon and the contemplative life of being the eternal essence, as complementary aspects of an ongoing process of spiritual awakening. It is not about passing through the psychic and pneumatic levels to the realization of Gnosis, because Gnosis is not about arriving anywhere. It is an ongoing process of transformation and transcendence, becoming and being, actively perfecting and passively appreciating. The original Christians symbolized the realization of Gnosis by the mystical marriage of Jesus and the goddess, because Gnosis is living life as a love affair of complementary opposites. It is marrying together the psychic path of transformation with the pneumatic path of transcendence. It is celebrating each moment as a new beginning on a never-ending journey of self-perfection and as a perfect end in itself. It is embracing the paradox that we are all Christ and each one of us is a separate lost soul. It is understanding that we are the whole become conscious through a part, so that the absolute may be relatively aware of itself. It is being universal mind, peering through the pinhole of a particular personality onto the cosmos we have collectively created. The authoritative teaching, a Christian text, states that the worst vices are ignorance and indifference. Ignorance is living without an awareness of the oneness. Indifference is retreating from life. Gnosis is the opposite of ignorance and indifference. It is communion and compassion. Communion is knowing the essential oneness of the mystery. Compassion is loving the many appearances of the mystery. The mystical marriage is living in communion and with compassion. Gnosis is being the one loving all. In the cosmos, but not of it. The psychic and pneumatic initiations combine to teach us how to be in the cosmos, but not of it. To help us understand what this means, the ancients likened life to a play. A modern version of this analogy would be watching a film. Our present problem is that we completely identify with the hero of the movie. That's great in the enjoyable bits, but when things get exciting, we are really terrified. We actually believe we are going to get horribly done in by the bad guys. The pneumatic initiation leads to the reassuring revelation that we are not actually in the film at all. Yet to simply be a disinterested witness of life is as crazy and unsatisfying as sitting in a cinema, constantly reminding oneself that the film is fantasy. That defeats the whole point of the film. In the same way, withdrawal into detachment defeats the whole point of life. There is a third possibility, however, which is a marriage of the two understandings. We abandon ourselves to the drama of the film, yet retain an implicit awareness that it is only a movie. This is, of course, exactly what we do when we go to the cinema, and it enables us to enjoy the film, even the scary bits. Small children often can't watch frightening films because they believe them to be real. In the same way, the spiritually immature are so completely swept up with the drama of life that they are full of fear. But the realization of gnosis enables us to be in the film, but not of it, and so appreciate it unreservedly. Free from fear, we are able to enjoy the extraordinary show we have laid on for ourselves without souring our pleasure with constant anxiety. We can take the risks that living demands, because we know that whilst our eidolon struts its stuff on the stage of the world, winning and losing, suffering and celebrating, laughing and crying, we are the witness who watches. There is one important respect in which the cinema analogy breaks down, however. To sit in a cinema is in itself not particularly pleasurable, but to commune with consciousness is to bathe in the bliss of our being. To experience the rich variety of experiences offered by life is a wonder, but to be conscious of the mystery of God is to have found the source of all joy. Plotinus explains, consciousness has two powers. First, to know its own contents. Second, to know that which transcends it. The first way of seeing belongs to consciousness when it is sane, but the second is consciousness in love, transported and drunk with nectar. Satisfied and fulfilled, it dissolves in contentment. Better to be drunk than too solemn for such delights. Love. It is easy with a book such as this one, full of old myths and philosophical concepts, to get a picture of gnosis as a heady, abstract theory about life. But the spiritually awake are heady with intoxication, not conceptualization. They are drunk with love, not sober with intellectual understanding. The purpose of philosophy is to open us to the possibility of ecstasy. The followers of the Christian sage Montanus were said to possess an infinite number of books, but called ecstasy the only true Christianity. Previously, we saw that the Gnostics imagined the motivation behind the mystery coming into manifestation to be the desire for self-knowledge. This can sound somewhat dry, but it is the only way of picturing something which is completely beyond understanding. Valentinus imagines the motivation behind manifestation to be love. Since the Father was creative, it seemed good to him to create and produce what was most beautiful and most perfect in himself. For he was all love, and love is not love if there is nothing to be loved. The nature of the mystery is love, but this remains only a latent potential unless there is something to love. So the mystery objectifies itself to give itself something beautiful to love, and in so doing, becomes love. We are the mystery, wanting to love and be loved. Everyone is searching for love, whether they know it or not. There is nothing better than love. It feels good because it is the good. Love is what happens when we connect deeply with another sentient being, because love is the way we experience the mysterious paradox of being the one appearing to be many. Love is the mystery, aware of the mystery. So when we plumb the depths of our being, we fall in love with ourselves. Plotinus enthuses, beauty evokes wonderment, delicious longing and trembling with delight. So when you see that you yourself are beautiful within, what do you feel? What is the Dionysiac exaltation that thrills through your being? The surging upwards of your psyche? These are the emotions of someone enchanted by the spell of love. Gnosis is not a theory. It is that love, passion of vision, known only to a lover, come to rest in that he loves, as Plotinus puts it. It is being content in the state of simple happiness that is naturally ours when we are free from ignorant fear and selfish craving. It is discovering we are more than we ever imagined or ever could imagine. It is a reality shift. It is the world turned inside out. Faith. Ironically, gnosis is knowing we don't know. As we progressively free ourselves from the conceptual matrix we have mistaken for reality, we become certain about less and less, until we find ourselves living in the mystery. It is an extraordinary twist that the great Gnostic injunction, know yourself, most famously finds its fulfillment in Socrates, whom the Oracle of Delphi declares the wisest man alive because he knows that he knows nothing. Gnosis is knowing nothing and loving everything. Paul teaches, make no mistake about it. If there is anyone among you who fancies himself wise, he must become a fool again to gain true wisdom. If anyone thinks he knows nothing yet in the true sense of knowing. If we want to experience what Paul calls the peace of God which surpasses all understanding, and what Plotinus calls the presence beyond all understanding, then we must be willing to go beyond understanding. We create conceptual models of reality because we are scared of life and want to know what is going on so that we can protect ourselves. But gnosis is understanding that we are utterly safe, because essentially we exist outside the human predicament altogether. When we are aware of this, we can let go of our conceptual reality and live in the mystery, allowing life to continually surprise us with its infinite innovations. We start out on the spiritual quest because we don't know who we are and what life is. Having filled our heads with all sorts of fancy ideas, as the realization of gnosis deepens, it dawns on us that we knew the answer in the first place. We began searching for meaning because life didn't make sense, and we were right. Life doesn't make sense. It's an absolute mystery. Yet, as we progress on our journey, something changes. We begin our search because we are terrified by the fact that we don't know what is going on. Through the process of awakening, we discover something wonderful. The source from which life originates and towards which it is evolving is more perfect, more beautiful, more loving than words can possibly communicate. Life is essentially good. This can sound like glib positivity, but it is not. Gnosticism is not about avoiding the fact of suffering and retreating into wishful thinking. It is expressing our natural compassion by doing all we can to ameliorate the terrible suffering we encounter, yet at the same time knowing that, despite appearances, all is well. It is understanding that everything arises from and is returning to the good. It is trusting that, ultimately, therefore, good will come from bad, and choosing to play an active part in that process. We can't understand the mystery of life, but we can come to trust it, and this transforms everything. Ironically, gnosis turns out to be synonymous with faith. But by faith, Gnostics don't mean blind belief in historical events as literalists do. They mean complete confidence in the life process. For Philo, faith is the queen of the virtues. Basilides eulogizes, faith is the best quality. Simon Magus teaches, gnosis and faith give the soul which chooses them permanent peace. The mystical marriage is living with gnosis of the eternal mystery and unshakable faith in the fundamental goodness of the unfolding drama of the temporal world. We start the spiritual quest because we experience life as a terrifying mystery which we want to understand. This is hell. We end by trusting in the goodness of life, which we know is a mystery beyond comprehension. This is heaven. The Treatise on the Resurrection boldly asserts, "Nothing within the account of the truth is truly difficult." Considering the complicated mythology and sophisticated philosophy we have been exploring, we could be forgiven for finding this statement ironically amusing. Yet, despite the apparent complexities, the essence of the Christian gospel of Gnosis could not be more simple. It is so simple, and so obvious, in fact, that it can take years of philosophical exploration before we finally understand that the good news it brings us is all we really need to know. Everything is okay. Summary. Gnosis is simultaneously being aware of the two poles of our syzygistic nature. Our present problem is that we are aware of appearing to be a person, but not of essentially being the mystery. The purpose of the Christian way is to bring us to an awareness of the mystery. Gnostic ethics, taught in the psychic stage of initiation, do not limit our actions with a set of moral injunctions, but encourage us to uncover our essential goodness so that we are free to act spontaneously from our authentic nature. Gnostic philosophy, taught in the pneumatic stage of initiation, does not limit our understanding with a set of doctrines, but teaches us to transcend thought altogether and be consciousness, which is the ground and source of all experience. Gnosis is neither being lost in appearances nor renouncing them. It is being in the cosmos but not of it. It is not about retreating from the world, but participating in the process of collectively creating heaven on earth. The psychic initiation teaches us to reach out to others with compassion, and the pneumatic initiation teaches us to reach inside and commune with our shared essence. The mystical marriage is living with compassion and in communion. Gnosis is being the one loving all. We can't understand the mystery of life, but we can come to trust it, and this transforms everything. Ironically, Gnosis turns out to be synonymous with faith. From our exploration of the secret teachings of the original Christians, it is clear that Christianity was not always the safe, pre-packaged, off-the-shelf religion it has become. The Christian way was once travelled by philosophical adventurers who proclaimed life to be an opportunity for self-discovery, for spiritual creativity, for living our own myths. Christianity may have ended up a power-crazed, literalist religion spreading guilt and fear, but it began as a movement of mystical enthusiasts with a beautiful vision of the meaning and mystery of life. Does it serve any purpose to resurrect their vision? The original Christians taught that although we have our eternal being outside the dramas of history, we are also a temporary part of the evolving cosmos. Can re-articulating their secret teachings after all this time play some positive role in this evolution? This book has involved us in studying the distant past and intuiting the eternal now, which lies beyond time altogether. Let's finally turn our attention to the future that we are presently creating and explore the current state of play in the ongoing struggle to unite heaven and earth. Chapter 12. The New Improved Testament. The most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. It is the source of all true art and all science. He to whom this emotion is a stranger, who can no longer pause to wonder and stand wrapped in awe, is as good as dead. His eyes are closed. Albert Einstein. Religion is the devil's greatest achievement. In the guise of religion, he has pulled off his most audacious coup. He has flagrantly masqueraded as God. He has had us bow down and worship him. He has had us commit every type of evil in the name of holiness. He has passed off his bigotry as God's opinions. He has had us segregate humanity into the ins and the outs, believers and non-believers, the saved and the damned. He has convinced us that God likes us, but not them, and convinced them that God likes them, but not us. And then, in a stroke of dark brilliance, he warns his faithful flock of sheep, "Be sure you do not pay heed to anyone but me, for the devil is a wily wolf, and he will surely trick you." The original Christians exposed the devil in disguise when, as part of their general critique of moribund Jewish literalism, they portrayed Jehovah as the arrogant demiurge. Not that the devil was overly perturbed. He just did what he always does. He put into effect a takeover operation of the new spiritual tradition these radicals had founded, turning Christianity into the most authoritarian and barbaric religion of all time. How does the devil do it? It's a confidence trick. In a world seething with insecurity, he offers certainty. He convinces his disciples that they, and they alone, know how it is. Blinded by opinion, they no longer see the reality of the mystery. They commit the only true blasphemy by conflating the relative with the absolute. Inflated with feelings of specialness, they willingly enlist into the devil's elite corps of martyrs and murderers, ready to die and kill for concepts and catchphrases. All for a promised payday, cunningly put off until the afterlife. Certainty divides us. Doubt unites us. We all have different ways of seeing life, which is not surprising, since we each have a unique experience of it. We agree and disagree, and that makes life interesting. But there is one thing that, if we are completely honest, we can all agree about. We can't find concepts big enough to express the enormity of life. It is beyond understanding. It is bigger than we can think. Let's put this in perspective. If we live to be 80 years old, that gives us 4,000 weeks to work life out. And we live in an infinite universe. And every inch is an enigma. As the pagan philosopher Metrodorus says so eloquently, in reality, none of us know anything. Not even whether we know anything or not. That is, apart from the devil's people, they know for sure. Theodotus writes, "Those that are most asleep think they are most awake, being under the power of very vivid and fixed dream visions, so that those who are most ignorant think they know most." When we talk of the devil, we are, of course, not expecting to be taken literally. We are talking about a mythical character. But sometimes mythic language is the most powerful with which to make a point. Christ is the uniter, and the devil is his evil brother, the divider. It is easy to spot when the divider is at work, because people see themselves as separate from each other and end up suffering needlessly. Selfishness and hypocrisy thrive. Conflicts erupt about irrelevant nonsense. The good becomes conflated with what is good for us. Blame is projected onto them. It is just as easy to see when the Christ is at work. Wherever the unifier goes, he leaves a legacy of love and understanding. People help each other spontaneously because it is their nature to be good. Selfless compassion works its miracles. Cries for vengeance turn to humble forgiveness. The cycle of suffering created by the an eye for an eye mentality is broken. People recognize that we are all one. We hope this book may contribute in some way to fulfilling Paul's vision of God's secret plan, that we all be made one with Christ through love. Our criticisms of literalist religion, like those of Gnostics before us, are not intended to instigate yet more conflict, but to clarify what is standing in the way of unity. Divisions cannot be overcome with wishy-washy wishful thinking. We must become conscious of their causes. If spirituality is to advance beyond the stage of conflicting regional religions, we must be willing to face the truth. History shows us that literalist religion, like nationalism, unites people only by dividing them from others. It may claim to represent the uniter, but actually it is the work of the divider. We have attempted to elucidate the secret teachings of the original Christians because we feel that something valuable was lost when the devil annexed Christianity. Something which, despite constant repercussions, has refused to die. Something which is resurfacing in our culture right now. Something which may be the future. Yes, this is a book with an agenda. We have not written a dispassionate survey of a quirky period in the history of ideas. That would be an absurd thing to do. Why, faced with the awesome mystery of existence and the inevitability of death, would we choose to waste years of our short lives investigating something unless we felt it to be important and that it might help? No, this book is not an academic exercise. It is written with a purpose, and that purpose is to change history. In the future, the past will be different. That much is for sure. Our picture of the past constantly changes, along with our picture of the present. The stories we tell about where we have come from matter because they inform our choices about where we want to go. Our reappraisal of the history and meaning of Christianity, the most influential religion in the history of the world, leaves us with a different past and the possibility of a better future. We feel that we potentially stand at the threshold of a positive new era in the unfolding evolution of consciousness. But the original Christians undoubtedly felt that too, and they could not have been more wrong. To make sure humanity doesn't make the same mistakes again, we must understand what really happened some 2,000 years ago. It's no good dismissing the absolutist claims of the Roman Church that kept us in the Dark Ages for so many centuries if we continue to believe their propaganda, which they have passed off as history. As long as we do that, the spectre of a return to spiritual fascism will always haunt us. We are not saying we have the truth about Christianity. History is always bogus. There can be no absolute and definitive description of the present, let alone the past. Each moment is too rich. The past, like the present, is an absolute that we can only express relatively. But just because any idea can at best be relatively true does not mean that we have to end up with a mush in which every idea is as good as any other. Some ideas are clearly better than others. Ideas can never embody the absolute truth, but they can get relatively nearer or further from it. We feel that our account of the origins and meaning of Christianity takes us nearer to the truth. In our previous book, The Jesus Mysteries, we presented overwhelming evidence that the Jesus story was a myth based on pagan allegories of a dying and resurrecting God-man. In this book, we have shown that the original Christians also adapted the pagan myth of the lost goddess, which was the partner myth to the God-man story. We have attempted to bring out the allegorical meaning of the whole Christian myth cycle and show its origins in the ancient Gnostic tradition. All of this evidence, taken together, we feel, conclusively endorses what we have called the Jesus Mysteries thesis, that Christianity was originally a Jewish adaptation of the pagan mysteries. By interpreting the Jesus myth as a factual biography, literalist Christianity has created a religion based on history rather than mystery. The great mythologist Joseph Campbell writes, "Wherever the poetry of myth is interpreted as biography, history, or science, it is killed. The living images become only remote facts of a distant time or sky. Furthermore, it is never difficult to demonstrate that as science and history, mythology is absurd. When a civilization begins to interpret its mythology in this way, the life goes out of it. Temples become museums, and the link between the two perspectives dissolves. Such a blight has certainly descended on the Bible and on a great part of the Christian cult." Ironically, rediscovering its Gnostic roots is probably the only hope that Christianity has of long-term survival. But that is not going to happen. Religions come and go, and Christianity looks more and more like a religion whose time has gone. It will merely be a matter of how long and how unpleasant its death throes turn out to be. But our agenda is not to rescue Christianity by resurrecting Christian Gnosticism. For all its essential profundity, Christian Gnosticism is of another time and an alien culture. After all, few today would choose to represent the concept of transcending identification with the body with the grotesque image of a man being tortured to death. We don't think in these ways anymore. The lives we lead are less routinely brutal, thank God. The dying and resurrecting God-man myth is a great story, but it's yesterday's story. For the same reason, we also are not suggesting rectifying centuries of patriarchal chauvinism with a return to goddess worship. Myths are hard to throw off, as Christianity demonstrates, but even harder to successfully revivify when the life has gone out of them. No, the future will not be a return to archaic myths. The goddess need not be rescued from captivity as a museum exhibit. The dying and resurrecting God-man can finally be allowed to rest in peace. We are not promoting the regressive romanticism of getting back to the lost ancient wisdom of the original Christians. But we are suggesting we do what they did. They reinvigorated the perennial philosophy of Gnosticism by successfully reworking it into a form that was accessible to their own day and age. Now is the time for us to do likewise. Occasionally, in the history of the West, there have been short periods in which the conditions were right for the Gnosis to be rediscovered, reinterpreted, and popularized, with massively positive effects on human culture. The heyday of classical Athens was such a period. It lasted for a mere 30 years, but it shaped the ancient world. The Florentine Renaissance was another such period. It also lasted for only a few decades, but it sowed the seeds of much of what is best in contemporary society. We are living in such a period of possibility today. The suffocating grip of organized religion is loosening, leaving us disorientated and hungry for meaning. New forms of spirituality are springing up everywhere. Many visionaries have realized the precious opportunity we have to transform our collective understanding of what it is to be alive. There has never been more fertile ground for the Gnosis to take root. But such conditions do not last long. Classical Athens and the Renaissance were both brutally suppressed by an unforeseen reactionary backlash. This could happen again. When the old certainties crumble, some move on, but others cling on, and with fanatical tenacity. Whilst literalist religion generally is in decline, fundamentalism, its extreme right wing, is more belligerently vocal than ever, particularly within Christianity and its old adversary, Islam. These people are in need of a lot of love and reassurance that life is safe. But in the meantime, they are extremely dangerous. Make no mistake about it. Feeling threatened and vulnerable, both Christian and Islamic fundamentalists are growing edgy and excitable, and could do with a divinely sanctioned scrap to relieve the tension. There is nothing like holy conflict to galvanize support for religion, and fundamentalists know it. The great irony is that, if they could but see it, Christian and Islamic fundamentalists are the same people. Their vision of life and how to live it is driven by the same needs and neuroses. What they hate in the other is a projection of what they hate in themselves. If fate had birthed them in the other culture, they would be fundamentalists of the other persuasion. The other great irony is that they have both completely misunderstood their spiritual traditions. Like Christianity, Islam was also originally a radical movement of Gnostic freethinkers. In their degenerate state as dogmatic religions, Christianity and Islam are irreconcilable enemies, fighting over whose cult is God's favourite. But they once taught the same perennial Gnostic philosophy, They weren't always subsidiaries of Beelzebub, Inc. Objective science and subjective gnosis. If Christianity and Islam could rediscover their common Gnostic roots, the world would enter a new era of spiritual tolerance and eclecticism. But this is not going to happen. Fundamentalism is growing, and this is in large part because there is a new cult in town, which has become so popular it is threatening the old established cults, and they are worried. They tried hard to kill it at birth, but it was unstoppable. They cannot begin to compete with its magic. Its devotees promise no end to the power it will eventually bestow upon humanity. This modern sorcery which has bewitched the world is science. The visionaries who inspired the birth of modern science were violently persecuted by the literalist Christian Church, which has left a bitter aftertaste of antagonism between science and religion, and rightly so. Science is based on the freedom to question. Religion is based on the duty to believe. But religion and spirituality are not the same thing. Whilst science is a natural enemy of religion, it is a natural ally of Gnostic spirituality. Indeed, science finds its roots in pagan Gnosticism, as the greatest scientists have acknowledged. Galileo and Copernicus saw themselves as reviving the Pythagorean tradition. Newton regarded his studies of ancient myths as more important than his scientific works, and claimed to have made the perennial Gnostic discovery of a common meaning underlying all mythology. In the 20th century, the great physicist Wolfgang Pauli was passionately interested in the Christian Gnostics. Werner Heisenberg, a winner of the Nobel Prize for Physics, asserted that modern science confirmed Pythagoras' beliefs to an inconceivable degree. Albert Einstein, an icon of science, writes of his experience of scientific inquiry in words that could be those of the great Gnostic masters. The most important function of science is to awaken the cosmic religious feeling and keep it alive. It is very difficult to explain this feeling to anyone who is entirely without it. The individual feels the nothingness of human desires and aims, and the sublimity and marvellous order which reveal themselves both in nature and in the world of thought. He looks upon individual existence as a sort of prison and wants to experience the universe as a single significant whole. Despite the fact that cutting-edge scientists present an ever more abstract picture of the universe, amongst the uninitiated, science is equated with materialism, perhaps the ultimate form of literalism. Materialism seeks to reduce everything to physics, because matter is all that exists. But the great physicists do not endorse this sort of crass reductionism. In fact, it is in physics, which should be the bedrock of materialism, that the worldview of scientific literalism has fallen apart. Science is not essentially literalist, however. It is the legacy of pagan Gnosticism, and at its heart are Gnostic values. Both science and Gnosticism are based on questioning what is taken for granted. Both refuse to accept anything on blind faith. Both regard conceptual pictures of the world as working models. Like the ancient Gnostics, modern scientists are internationalists who embrace each other's discoveries regardless of nationality or political ideology. In fact, Gnostic and scientist mean exactly the same thing. Knower. Science and Gnosticism are complementary ways of exploring the mysteries of existence. Science is concerned with objective knowledge about the cosmos. Gnosticism is concerned with subjective self-knowledge. Science is concerned with the tangible appearances, Gnosticism with the ineffable essence. Science is about solving the relative mysteries of the world of becoming. Gnosticism is about dissolving into the absolute mystery of being. Science is attempting to understand something so complex that it can't be comprehended. Gnosticism is attempting to understand something so simple that it can't be comprehended. Science is a collective venture over time. Gnosis is immediate and can only be attained individually. Could the future see a return to the ancient understanding of subjective spirituality and objective science as complementary sides of humanity's exploration of existence? This would require a revolution in the way we understand life, a rejection of literalism and the rejuvenation of Gnosticism. That may seem unlikely, but the future often hits us from the direction we weren't looking in. Perhaps it is not the birth of the space age we are witnessing, but of the inner space age, in which we begin a collective exploration of consciousness and the great existential mysteries of life and death. 21st century Gnosticism. The history of humanity can be understood as a battle between good and bad ideas. Bad ideas are like viruses that can infect whole populations, causing them to behave in the most horrendous ways. The 20th century probably saw more people die needlessly from bad ideas than from disease epidemics. The only cure is to replace bad ideas with good ideas. If we want to revivify the essence of Gnosticism in a new form for the 21st century, this is what we must do. It's as simple as that. We could start by dumping an entire rogue's gallery of bad ideas concocted by Christian literalists. Original sin. That's such a bad idea. Let's never again tell our children they've been born bad and reassure them instead that they are naturally good. The Bible is the Word of God. Ridiculous idea. There is only one way to God. Obvious nonsense. The Day of Judgment and the Resurrection of the Flesh. Spooky ideas. The world is a bad place and we should hate it. In the face of the wonders all around us, that's just ungrateful. Eternal damnation. Horrible, grotesque, really, really bad idea. God likes some people more than others. Please, what sort of God is that? Sex is evil. If you believe this, you must be doing it wrong. God is male. What could that possibly mean? Does God have a penis? Men are more spiritual than women. This idea must have been thought up by a man who never had a mother. God has opinions, and only some people know what they are. That's got to be one of the worst ideas ever, because it is regularly used to justify a whole edifice of bad ideas. Let's imagine jettisoning this sort of pernicious nonsense and replacing it with some simple but profound Gnostic ideas. Let's start with Gnosticism's big idea, which is very big indeed. It is this: all is one. Can you imagine the massive transformation that would occur in human culture with the spread of this idea? We would have unconditional love for all beings as expressions of a common essence. We would become tolerant, generous, cooperative, altruistic. In short, understanding ourselves to be kindred, we would become kind. Let's imagine a society where the taboo against stating the obvious is broken and we all openly acknowledge that life is a mystery and we wouldn't want it any other way. We all know how we kill a relationship with a lover as soon as we start to think we know who they are and put them into a conceptual box. It is the same with life. When we think we know how it is, it goes dead on us. It is the same with our relationship with ourselves. When we think we know who we are, we imprison our ineffable nature in the confines of a limited thought, and the magic goes out of existence. Let's imagine the Gnostic vision that the purpose of life is about exploring the mystery becoming a commonly held worldview. Let's imagine the strange notion currently in vogue that the purpose of life is to accumulate wealth being regarded as on a par with believing that the earth is flat. Let's imagine a time when presidents win elections by promising to create the best opportunities for the electorate to expand their awareness, plumb the depths of possibility, reach for new levels of experience, transcend their fear of death, and really be alive. Let's imagine a revival of Gnostic partnership spirituality in which men and women value each other's characteristically different perspectives on life. Let's imagine a balanced form of spirituality, honouring both the archetypally male obsession with disembodied, impersonal, universal essence, and the archetypally female infatuation with embodied, personal, particular appearances. Let's imagine women in love with men's ability to make the truth conscious by struggling to articulate it, and men in love with women's silent sense of having naturally known it all along. Let's imagine liking learning from each other. Let's imagine being able to laugh at the humour of our predicament. It is a fascinating fact that for most fundamentalists, spirituality isn't a laughing matter. A good yardstick of how deep someone's spiritual understanding goes is how precious they are about their beliefs and how seriously they take themselves. Gnostics can laugh at themselves and their ideas, because it reminds them how limited all ideas are, and at what is sacred, because either nothing is sacred or everything is. Those who worry that God easily takes offence are confusing God with the devil, who is a bully and can't bear being ribbed. After all, it was God who came up with a reality based on uniting two irreconcilable principles, and jokes ever since have been variants on that original wisecrack. Let's imagine no more self-righteous spiritual autocrats who put their own opinions into God's mouth to give them authority, and a return instead to Gnostic guides who encourage us to challenge all the beliefs we have inherited unquestioningly from others. Let's imagine no more hierarchies of professional priests negotiating a spiritual career structure, and a return instead to the natural model for spiritual organization, a group of students around an authentic master. Let's imagine no more spiritual power trippers who seek to enlarge their congregations, and a return instead to genuine teachers who seek to be redundant because they want their students to spiritually mature and find their own way, not cling on like lost children. Let's imagine replacing religious divisions with an all-embracing eclecticism which acknowledges that the absolute truth can never be said, but that relative truths can be expressed in various conceptual vocabularies. We are living in amazing times in which the wisdom of the world is available at the local bookshop. Gnosticism's internationalist spirit is just what we need to synthesize a common human spirituality out of the plethora of approaches. In a universe which is slowly evolving towards conscious unity, this moment has been a long time coming, and we should embrace it wholeheartedly. But this is not to say that we should carve out some monolithic one-world religion. That would just be a recipe for the destruction of the variety of human culture. Gnosticism is about unity and variety. It is literalists who want to impose one religion on the world, as the Roman Church attempted when it laid waste our pagan heritage and gave us the Dark Ages. We don't want that again. Let's imagine a culture which treats spirituality as a completely private matter, like sexuality. Let's imagine as much spiritual variety as possible, with everyone finding their own idiosyncratic path, for, as Theodotus teaches, all people, according to their stage of development, possess the gnosis of God in a way special to themselves. Yet let's also imagine this diversity being understood as different approaches to a shared endeavour. All spiritual practices and philosophies fit into the simple initiatory framework of the ancient mysteries. We are either engaged in exploring the range and depth of experience, the psychic or soul initiation, or in becoming conscious of consciousness, which is the ground of all experience, the pneumatic or spirit initiation. If these two aspects of the spiritual path are understood as complementary, then everyone, in their completely different ways, can be seen as participating in the same adventure. Let's imagine no longer seeing spirituality as something otherworldly and esoteric, but as inherent in the natural processes of ordinary human existence. Birth, childhood, sex, parenting, aging, death, joy, suffering, waking, dreaming, sleeping, and so on. Let's stop attempting to add a special spiritual dimension to life and recognize that life is the spiritual process. For, as Plotinus assures us, this is it, this and no other. Not what it chanced to be, but simply what it must be, but without the must. Let's imagine a life-affirming spirituality which sees self-knowledge and true enjoyment as the same thing, which embraces pleasure, delights in the senses, and is committed to joy, which understands that the universal quest for the good manifests in each one of us as the desire for good experiences, which encourages us to have a good time, but not at the expense of others, because we are all one, and others are also consciousness trying to have a good time. Let's imagine spiritual philosophy being understood as simply a clever way to really be happy. After all, happiness is what everyone is naturally driven to desire. As Sophia herself teaches, with all the worry with which they work at countless enterprises, mortal men travel by different paths, but all strive to reach one and the same goal. Happiness. This is the goal which, once obtained, leaves nothing more to be desired. Let's dare to imagine the world we really want. Why not? It's our collective dream, and we can dream it any way we choose. Let's imagine humanity waking up at last from its nonchalant numbness, overcome with awe at the inexplicable miracle that we are. Let's imagine living our lives as a celebration of the great mystery in which we live and move and have our being. Let's imagine a world in which we embrace the great Gnostic injunction to love one another, not because we should, but, as Paul says, because we are parts of each other. Let's imagine fulfilling the great ambition which motivates evolution. Let's imagine heaven on earth. This concludes Jesus and the Lost Goddess by Timothy Freke and Peter Gandy. Narrated by Rory Barnett. Copyright 2001 by Timothy Freke and Peter Gandy. This unabridged audiobook is recorded by arrangement with Harmony Books, an imprint of the Crown Publishing Group, a division of Penguin Random House LLC, and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.